You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds. Chat with Traders is sponsored by Trade the Pool. Are concerns about limited buying power, insufficient capital, or fear of losing your own money preventing you from advancing your trading capabilities? Trade the Pool is an online stock trading prop firm that offers funding for stock traders. Demonstrate your skills, trade their capital, and keep your profits. You can engage in intraday trading and now swing trading on Trade the Pool with any U.S. stock or ETF. The procedure is straightforward. Pay an evaluation fee, successfully complete the evaluation, and get funded. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
Trading in the financial markets involves a risk of loss. Podcast episodes and other content produced by Chat with Traders are for informational or educational purposes only and do not constitute trading or investment recommendations or advice.
Markets, speculation, and risk. This is the Chat with Traders podcast.
We're on episode 245. If you're new to the show, very warm welcome to you and everyone else. Thank you for coming back to join us today. I'm Tessa, co-host of Chat with Traders. I'm excited about our guest today. He was interviewed in Jack Swagger's Unknown Market Wizards. From early on, as a rebel who avoided groupthink, he sought out contrarian trading opportunities in overhyped or deeply oversold stocks and commodities. Blessed by early trading successes, he retired to a beach in Thailand in the late 90s and traded his account full-time only to experience tragedy less than a year later. Our guest today is Jason Shapiro. Ladies and gentlemen, before we tune into this fascinating interview with Jason, I'd first like to quickly take this opportunity to introduce the new host who's joining me today. His name is Ian Cox. Ian will add another dynamic to the show due to his unique background, experience, and perspectives in his own way and own style that I hope you will all come to appreciate. If you haven't yet listened to episode 244, where I share an interview I did with Ian, please listen to it to learn more about him. Ian, welcome aboard to Chat with Traders.
Thank you, Tessa, for the nice introduction. I'm looking forward to starting here with Chat with Traders and getting a chance to interview top traders from around the world. And I'm excited to learn from them.
As this is your debut interview, how do you feel about it?
You know, I've read about many of these great traders through the Market Wizards books, but having a chance to finally talk to someone live and ask them questions and get a chance to connect with them and learn the lessons that they've learned is exciting for me.
So Ian, without giving up too much detail now, because listeners will want to tune into this fascinating interview shortly, what were some of the things that really stood out to you during the interview?
Many of the painful lessons that Jason learned, which drove him eventually to give up his opinions on the market and instead focus in on what the market is telling him. And thus he became a great market tape reader.
Okay, well, without further ado, let us roll straight into it. Ladies and gentlemen, we are so pleased to present Jason Shapiro.
According to the book, Unknown Market Wizards, that you interviewed with Jack Swagger, he mentions that you went to a London business school.
Yeah, that was for a master's degree. Undergraduate, uh-huh. I was a finance major. And then I worked for, I don't remember exactly how long, 5 years, maybe 5 or 6 years I went to work. And then I went to London Business School for a year to their master's in finance program.
Did you find what you learned in that school helped you in any way with trading?
I'm not really going to say that it necessarily helped me with trading. It definitely helped me understand more about the fundamental side of markets and financial theory. So I don't really use, I would say, financial theory per se in my trading, but I think it definitely helps to understand it just because the more you know, I think the better off you are, and you can choose to use or not use, you know, the knowledge that you pick up. But there was nothing really in trade. I mean, you know, I took options courses. It helped me understand how to value an option, but truthfully, does that help in trading? I don't trade options, but even if I did, I mean, options are pretty well priced, you know, so the understanding how to price an option wasn't necessarily helpful in trading, but it's still good to know. It's still good to understand these things.
Right. In the book, it mentioned that you went on vacation to Africa and you held a position during that time. Tell us about that.
Probably the most valuable lesson I learned while I was in business school, which had nothing to do with business school.
Oh, please tell us.
Yeah, I mean, I just had a position in Hang Seng Futures where for, you know, whatever reason I was bullish. And, you know, at the time, this was right, I would say, as the internet was starting. I remember when I was in school, we could download internet pages, but it took about 5 to 10 minutes to download a page. So really, I was going to a Bloomberg screen that we had in the library and looking at markets and charts. And my broker was faxing me intraday charts once a day. And that's kind of how I was trading the Hang Seng Index at the time. And I was still pretty much a shorter term trader, holding things for 2 or 3 days, usually that type of thing, and over trading still. But at the time that I went away, for whatever reason it was, I was bullish the Hang Seng Index. And I had a big position on. And I was going to Africa for a month, and I knew that I wasn't really going to be able to have contact. You know, this is pre-cell phone. So, you know, I just kind of left an order with my broker to kind of stop me out if it goes down to here, and otherwise just let it go. And after a month, when I got to a place where I could speak to him, you know, the market was up quite a bit. And of course, I told him to sell. And I think if I went away for another month, I probably would have made twice as much money, right? But it just helped with the lesson of, you know, it's an old Jesse Livermore saying that the money is made in the sitting. I made more money in that month than I had made, you know, all year trying to trade in and out of the market.
So did this experience influence your later trading? Did you become more patient and let the trade unfold over time? Did this tempt you to be...
100%.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, my trades now usually last, you know, at least my good ones last 2 to 6 months.
So in the book Unknown Market Wizards, you shared that you had, you got a chance to live in Thailand.
I did live in Thailand. Yes. When I finished business school, I moved to Thailand and got married. I had made, mostly because of that trade when I was in Africa, but I'd made a good amount of money. I'd say 60 to 70% off that one trade, but I made a good amount of money while I was in business school. And I just decided I didn't want to really go to work. So I moved to Thailand and I started trading from there.
Wow. That sounds like a dream come true. How did that go for you?
Yeah. It's funny that you use those words, because so often what sounds like a dream come true is not what you think it is, right?
Uh-huh.
So again, it was based on the same type of psychology. I went back to the idea of, you know, look at me, you know what I mean? All my friends are working every day and putting on a suit and tie, and I'm sitting here with my toes in the sand in Thailand, and aren't I a genius? And I'm just having fun trading and living in Thailand. And I think it took me 9 months before I blew out again.
When you look back, what were some of the lessons you learned from that? And did you change your strategy from earlier?
Yeah, I think the main lesson that was, instilled on me in that situation was, you know, don't fight the tape. I was bearish the U.S. stock market for, I don't remember why, trying to be contrarian, you know, and it was going up all the time. And I was fighting the tape the whole way. And that's how I lost my money. And yes, it definitely affected how I trade. I mean, after that, now I'm back to broke. I really sat down and had to decide, you know, what I was going to do about this. If I really wanted to continue trading, then I had to stop, you know, with this up and down thing, you know, and blowing out, making and blowing out. And so I had done a good job of journaling my trades back in those days. So I really took a few months and went through this and really tried to develop a process based on that, you know, what was working, what was not working. And let's try to eliminate the things that were not working. And let's try to focus on the things that were working over time. And that was really the beginning of me starting to develop a repeatable process in trading.
I see. So for a while there, you were you trading based on your opinions instead of the tape, right?
For the most part, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I think the market's going up for whatever reason. I think the market's going down for whatever reason. And I was getting stuck into a lot of, you know, psychological traps that, you know, we all get stuck in with trading. And I needed to eliminate those. You know, you're bearish, you're shorting, the market's going up. Okay, maybe you're stopping loss, but then you're shorting again. And it's this whole idea of, well, now you can't miss it when it does go down because you've been shorting so much and the market's gone up so much and you've lost, you know, now you can't miss it. So you have to, you know, those kind of thought processes are very debilitating to your P&L over time. So I was kind of still stuck in that because I was young, you know, and I lacked sort of the experience. So you know, so eliminating those type of thought processes were a big part of it.
How long have you considered yourself to be a contrarian trader? How early did you adopt that viewpoint?
Pretty much, I would say within a couple of years of trading, that was sort of my take on things. I've always been, I would say, a contrarian person. And so therefore, it was a natural gravitation to being a contrarian trader. I think that my definition of contrarian, what a contrarian trader is, has changed over time. But even when I wasn't doing what I'm doing now, I considered myself contrarian. I just had a different definition of what that was.
So when we talk about being a contrarian, I think it's helpful to understand who are we being contrarian to, for example. And so I'd like to take a look at some of the players involved in the market. And one extreme type is often referred to as the dumb money. And an investment legend that the father of President Kennedy was hearing stock investing advice from the Shoeshine Boys. And to him, this was a contrarian sell signal because these type of people typically get into stocks, you know, near the end of the move. Based on this, legend has it that he sold all his stocks months before the 1929 stock market crash. So do you consider any other types of investors, groups or institutions, which might be in the dumb money category?
I've considered just about all money over time to be dumb money. And I think that the most important part of it is when they're all agreeing, right? When everybody is in agreement, that's when it becomes dumb money. And it makes sort of, and you go back to business school and financial theory, it makes sense on a financial theory basis, to me at least, because the first thing we learn is the market is a discounting mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. So when everybody suddenly is saying something, then isn't that discounted in the market already, right? And that's where efficient market comes in. And it's more than a question of if they're just saying it, it's a question of if they've actually put their money in. So if everybody's already put their money into a certain idea and they're all piling their money into that idea, then isn't that going to already be discounted? And I think that that's really the key is, for me at least, I believe the discounting mechanism, people use price as a discounting mechanism. I like to use participation, which is measuring if the money's actually gone in there as a discounting mechanism. So it's not a question of, hey, this asset's gone from 50 to 100, therefore it's discounted in the good news. It's more like every single person that I know of has their money in this, therefore it's already discounted in the good news.
Yeah. So do you think that one way to measure participation is to say, look at the media? Like, for example, it is said when magazines which don't specialize in stocks, like say Time Magazine, Newsweek, and others, have a front cover article about stocks or commodities, it frequently signals the end of the move in that market and a great time to take the opposite side of the trade. Do you consider these type of non-financial magazines to be a a good contrarian indicator when they have their front cover articles?
I don't think that there's any doubt about it. and I mean, just as an example, there was a, and I've talked about this a lot, but there was a front page of The Economist article that came out that had the cover of, on the cover had wheat on the cover, you know? Uh-huh. And that was a few months ago, right at the exact top of wheat. I think wheat's down 40% since then. So that's a good example of that. And, you know, you get into the kind of why that is, you know, thing. And I think it's a question of, you know, magazines are looking to sell magazines, right?
Right.
So they're going to put what is going to grab people's attention on the cover and what is popular on the cover, right? When wheat hasn't gone anywhere in 5 years, nobody's putting wheat on the cover of a magazine because nobody cares, right? Mm. So they want to put the exciting thing on. And by definition, the exciting thing on is what everybody's participating in. And therefore, that's when the market's going to turn.
Right, right. I remember while trading the oil drillers back in 1999, I saw a bearish front cover article on The Economist talking about drowning in oil. And this came out when oil hit $10 a barrel. And it turned out to be a fantastic contrary indicator, as that was the bottom of the market.
Yeah, I think that there's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of examples like that, right? And not only the bottom of the market when oil was at 10, I think oil was sitting at $10 a barrel for years at that point. And then finally they put an article on the cover, like you said, and there you go. Then oil took off from there, right?
Yeah. Well, how about the publications and TV who specialize in stocks, like Investor's Business Daily, Wall Street Journal, CNBC, and others? I mean, shouldn't these financial media sources be part of the smart money crowd? I mean, do you notice much of a difference between these as a contrarian indicator? Are some more noticeably more reliable as a contrary indicator?
So I don't read Investor's Business Daily, although I think if I were a stock trader, I would probably read it religiously. I have a lot of respect for what those guys have done. As far as the Wall Street Journal, and I don't really read the Wall Street Journal either, but I do spend a lot of time because I have the TV on all day on Bloomberg TV and CNBC. And I do think that they can be great contrarian indicators. Yes. When you have people come on there all day and the same people are saying the same thing, it's like I say, you know, that they're all discounting this stuff in. I think they're even a better contrarian indicator because this is, you know, where people are coming on and talking consistently. And again, when they all are agreeing, then that's the time to be contrarian to that, or at least start thinking about being contrarian to that. I mean, people think like there's a difference between, you know, some professional so-called money manager and some retail guy and or person. And to me, the only difference is this person, you know, got their MBA and got a job. You know, the market doesn't, you know, being highly educated in this stuff doesn't give you a better chance at beating the market. As time has proven, professional money managers don't beat the market either, right? So when all professional money managers are saying the same exact thing, I think it's a great time to be contrarian. That.
Interesting. So despite, you know, many in the public might think, well, these people on CNBC and these money managers, they have a lot of education, they have a lot of experience, and they're much sharper than, you know, those magazines say that don't focus in on that. And so you'd think that, oh, they would know. I mean, they would make smart choices generally and know when to get in, you know, near the bottom or sell somewhere near the top, but not based on your experience and what the evidence shows, right?
I think the evidence shows the complete opposite. I fade the people on CNBC on a consistent basis.
So
and it's not a personal thing, you know what I mean? It's
right?
Just like if everybody is coming on CNBC and saying the same thing, then I am definitely looking to go the other way.
So in your experience, typically how long do you find that they maintain those positions, those attitudes toward being bullish or bearish a particular stock? Because the old saying, the trend is your friend. Are you looking for players that were formerly bearish to flip bullish, say on the TV, or have you identified, say, certain people on the show to be consistently like perma bulls or perma bears?
There's definitely some of that. There are definitely some people who have certain personalities, and you can sort of get a feeling for when, yeah, they are capitulating and therefore you want to go the other way. My preference is really when there's more consensus and when all the people are coming on TV and agreeing on the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. You know, that's really where what I'm interested in more than anything else. Although, like I say, there are some people that are wrong on a very consistent level.
I see. And so what publication do you most frequently use to help you locate contrarian opportunities?
You know, I don't really read any of the newspapers or anything like that. It's really the TV. You know, CNBC has a lot of people coming on there talking every day. And then at the end of the day, they have the wrap-up shows, Fast Money, which I like to call Fade Money. I listen to that. I watch that religiously every day, and if I do miss it, then they do have it on a webcast, and I listen to that because that has guests and it has commentators, and when they all come into agreement and there's no doubt about you know, their agreement, then that's interesting to me.
Do you use the Commitment of Traders report put out by the CFTC?
I do. I use it extensively. That's really my main data source. So
okay. I noticed on the COT report that there are three primary players, the commercials, the large speculators, and the small traders. Is there one that you would consider to be more in the smart money crowd, or how would you view those three different groups?
So, yeah, I mean, the commercials will have on the exact opposite position as these speculators, right? For every buyer, mm-hmm. there's a seller. For every long, there's a short, right? So to me, it's two groups, commercials, speculators, right? And I look for that to line up when I'm taking a contrarian trade. Now, again, going back to financial theory, you could argue that commercials are hedging, right? There should be a cost to hedging. And therefore, the speculators are capturing that cost as a profit, right, over time. And to me, that's what trend following is, right? This is why trend following over time has made money, because they're basically capturing the cost of hedging that the commercials are giving up. And that's one side of it. The other side of it, which is what I do, is that extremes, when commercials are extremely short and speculators are extremely long, that's when a good turn can happen. And that's when I go the opposite to speculators and with the commercials.
You've seen the headlines. Bonds are making a comeback. But if you've ever tried to invest in bonds, you know what a clunky, complicated, broken experience it can be. That's why at Public, they took fixed income and fixed it. Now you can find, evaluate, and buy thousands of bonds with an investing experience designed this century. They started at the beginning, reimagining the bond screener with an intuitive design that helps you zero in on the exact kinds of bonds you're looking for. Then they made it easier to evaluate each investment opportunity with better data in the places you need it most. Finally, they made investing in bonds as straightforward as stocks or any other asset. Add fixed income to your portfolio with corporate, treasury, and municipal bonds. Go to public.com/bondspodcast to get started. This podcast is sponsored by Public. Full disclosures can be found at public.com/bonds.
Are you a developing or seasoned day trader who trades the U.S. markets? Is the only thing stopping you from getting to the next level is having enough capital to trade? Trade the Pool is a unique online stock trading prop firm that funds stock traders worldwide. Not having to risk your own capital can help you focus on other things like making better decisions on your trades. There's no PDT rules to worry about. You got more than 12,000 stocks and ETFs to trade, long or short, and professional tools at your side. How you get funded is you show them your skills through a straightforward evaluation process. Once you pass the evaluation, you get funded and trade with their pool of money and split the profits. Don't let the lack of buying power, capital, or fear of losing your own money prevent you from taking your trading to the next level. Visit tradethepool.com/chat to learn more.
So And that's how I trade. I'm not a trend follower. I'm sort of a turn picker, you know, contrarian turn picker. So I'm trying to be contrarian mass positioning by speculators, which will in turn have the opposite mass positioning by commercials. And it's not really a question of if it works all the time, because it doesn't work all the time, as nothing works all the time. But for me, what it gives is good risk reward, right? If you have speculators massively long here, then clearly they're discounting in a lot of good news. And should the market, in fact, start to turn the other way, then they all start getting stopped out, right? And so the move can be large. So it's just a question of risk reward, you know. It only, like, my trades only work over time. It's been somewhere around 37% of the time. But my payout is, you know, over 4 to 1. So if I can make 4, lose 1, make 4, you know, make 4 37% of the time and lose 1 the other 63% of the time, over time that adds up to profitable P&L.
I see. Yeah. Would the commercials and the stock indices have more flexibility in switching from bearish to bullish stances? Because unlike a commodity producer who depends on receiving enough revenues to cover their costs of production, a commercial player in stocks doesn't have the same limitation?
I think that could be true, which is why you see quite a quicker movement, I think, in the stock index COT data a lot. Than you do in commodities. And I had never thought of it in the way that you just said that, but that could be a good explanation for why that is.
I see. Does this affect the power of going opposite of them? So say a commercial in the commodity sector, since they are almost always short, if they switch to being neutral or net long, is that more something that you take notice of than say if a commercial in the stocks switches from bearish to bullish?
I wouldn't say it's something I definitely take notice in the commodities when, yeah, commercials get long. It's a pretty loud message, right? Mm-hmm. But with the stock indices, I just, you know, I take all this data with the COT and I you have to index it to itself, right? Because mm-hmm. if you're waiting for speculator or commercials that say to get super long gold before you buy it, you're never going to buy gold because they're never getting super long gold, right? Mm-hmm. So it has to be relative to where they've been in history, kind of thing, right?
How often do you see the commercials and the commodities get neutral or even net long?
It depends which commodities, but like things like the metals, it's very rare to see that. It's a once in a few year thing. I mean, right now we have a situation where the commercials are actually getting net long silver for the first time in quite a while. But it happens. We had a situation in palladium where commercials almost never get long, and they got long a few months ago. I think it was about 5-6 months ago, and it was right before a pretty massive move in palladium. So,
oh wow,
definitely worth paying attention to. Yes.
Generally, do the commercials and large speculators use similar levels of leverage? Is either group less likely of getting liquidated?
I mean, I don't know the answer to that. Uh-huh. I would guess that the commercials, given that they have, you know, physical behind it, are less likely to be liquidated than speculators are. You know, speculators mm-hmm. are, you know, the thing starts going against them. You know what I mean? They have stop loss levels. They have whatever they do. Moving averages start getting hit and they start liquidating, right?
Right.
Whereas commercials don't really have to do that.
Right. Last week, I was looking at the COT report for the S&P 500, and I noticed an unusually large difference between the large speculators and the commercials. And this difference was greater now than it was at the March 2020 lows. Now that the commercials are heavily long and the large speculators are heavily short, I mean, what's going on with that? Why do you think they would be at such extreme opposite ends? Because we could consider both of them as a very knowledgeable group. So what are they looking at to cause them to be totally opposite of each other?
I mean, I think why speculators are largely short the S&P 500 here is, you know, they're bearish. I mean, the world is semi falling apart, right? There's everything in the world to be bearish about, you know, theoretically in the stock market. You're not going to find a lot of people that are making fundamental bullish arguments here, right?
Right.
So therefore they're short. And if they're short, well, then the commercials are long because that's the opposite side. But important to note that that is not the case for things like the Dow positioning. It's mm-hmm. also not the case for things like the NASDAQ positioning. In fact, 2 weeks ago, the speculators were had one of their largest long positioning in NASDAQ that they've had in quite a while, right?
Uh-huh.
Right before this market started to go down, of course. So, you know, looking at the S&P in and of itself can be a little bit dangerous. You know, you need to look at sort of all the indices across to really see if there's a bias there.
If you had to guess, why do you think the speculators would be short S&P and long NASDAQ?
It's a trade that's worked for, you know, it's probably been the trade of the century.
Uh-huh.
You know, long tech, you know, long US tech and, you know, versus anything has worked, right?
Mm.
And if you're going to be long, I guess, then that's what people think they want to be long. You know, I mean, the market started to squeeze up from the June lows. And in the June lows, you had speculators short all of these indices, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then as we started to squeeze and they had to buy things, what they were buying was the NASDAQ. You know, that's where the beta is.
Right.
It's theoretically where the growth is. And that's been the trade of the century. So that's where they go, I guess.
Right, right. What's your viewpoint on looking at or following stock analysts? Are they a good contrarian indicator? Like, say, if they upgrade stocks from, you know, buy to strong buy and raise a price target, what do you think about following them? Or do you?
I think it's garbage. I wouldn't follow stock analysts. You know what I mean? I wouldn't follow anybody.
Mm.
Certainly the stock analyst thing. I've had friends that are that have worked as stock analysts. And, you know, there's so many reasons why a stock analyst upgrades a stock or downgrades. Well, I don't know about downgrade because they never downgrade, but there's so many reasons why they upgrade a stock, some of it which might, quite frankly, have to do with their investment banking relationships with that company and all that kind of stuff. You know, I think it's the whole thing is a scam, quite frankly.
Do you look at short interest levels, put call ratios, VIX index?
I do look at put call ratios, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't really look at short interest because I don't trade individual stocks, right?
Mm-hmm.
And also, I think short interest has, I'm not exactly sure how often they report that, but I think it's got like a 1 month lag time or something like that, if I'm not mistaken, which I could be, but I don't really look at it because I don't trade individual stocks. But put call ratios, I definitely look at, in particular on the indices.
Have you heard of the AAII? Investor sentiment survey?
I have. Yep. I look at that every week when it comes out. I look at all these kind of survey type of things. Surveys can be good, but the truth is it's not money at stake. You know, it's just a survey. Hey, are you bullish or bearish? Well, it doesn't mean very much, right? I'm bearish. Well, are you short is the real question, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm bullish. Okay. You might be bullish, but are you long, right? That's the real question. And that's what's so good about the COT is it's real money, right? It shows what money is actually doing rather than what money is talking about doing.
Well, what about a lot of investors look at price earnings ratios and price to sales ratios, price to book and things like that as an indicator that stocks may be getting frothy or maybe undervalued. What are your thoughts about using such indicators?
I think that when the market hits the top, those indicators are going to say that the market was overvalued.
Mm-hmm.
But it will probably say that they were overvalued for 2 years before that too, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they say that they're looking at price to book and price to sales and price to earnings as an indicator. Well, where the hell were they a year and a half ago when all these stocks were trading at 200 times sales, right? Were they all short? Because they mm-hmm. certainly should have been. And the point is, you should have been short at 50 times sales. And then it went to 200 times sales. So if you're short at 50 times sales, and once you go to 200 times sales, you got run over, right? But, you know, do they work over long? You know, you talk to like Jeremy Grantham, guys like that, the work, but Jerry Grantham doesn't care. He'll get out at 50 times sales. He'll watch it go to 200 times sales, and then he'll watch it go from 200 times sales back down to 5 times sales, right? And he'll have gotten out at 50, as he should have, right?
Right. But
most, that's not trading, that's investing, right? Right. So I think from an investor point of view, over time that will work, but it's just like anything else. You have to have the discipline to be able to get out at 50 times sales and watch it go to 200 times sales and say, I'm not going to chase this here. It's dumb, right? Mm-hmm. So I think those are great tools for investing. And I use them sometimes when I make analysis and I write a newsletter. So like sometimes in my newsletter, I will mention stuff like that. Like, you know, I'll get re-bullish the stock market when Apple's back at 3 times sales, which is where it spent, 20 years. And then suddenly it went from 3 times sales to whatever, 10 or 20 times sales. And now I think it's on its way back to 3. I think they're good sort of measurements for things like that, but I personally don't use them to trade necessarily.
I see. So I like to jump into the timing of when you put on the trade. Mm-hmm. What's kind of a trigger for you, or what are some triggers to, I mean, you've identified certain stocks or commodities as being extremely overbought, very high levels of participation, long or short. What do you look for of when to put on a trade?
So it's a good question, because it's more as important, if not more important, than the whole crowdedness of the trade. But I'm looking for a market confirmation before I will put on a trade. To me, it's not like, okay, let's say I'm trading off of COT. Okay, this market is showing that the speculators are massively short and the commercials are massively long. I want to get long. I'm not going to just get long because of that, right? I'm going to wait for the market to confirm this. And I think that no matter how anybody trades and no matter what their process is, they should always look for market confirmation before they do something. And this goes back to my experience in Thailand, where I was shorting the US stock market. I was just shorting it. Market was up, I'd short it. Okay, it would close on highs, I'd get stopped out. Next day, I'd short it again, right? I think you need, it's so important to be patient for the market to confirm your viewpoint before you do anything. So for me to confirm my viewpoint based on how I trade and based on what my method is, I am looking for what I like to call a news failure event. And what that means is, let's say whatever market I'm looking at is showing some kind of huge bias that speculators are hugely short. So I'm looking to get long. Well, at that point, I'm kind of monitoring the market very closely as to what people are thinking, why the market's going down, what they are thinking about, right? That's driving it down. What kind of news flow is bullish and what kind of news flow is bearish? So if I'm looking to get long, I'm looking for some kind of bearish news to come out and then the market to not go down on that news. And so the market's rejecting that news. And that's where I'll get long, because at that point, it's telling me that all that is discounted in. The market just got the exact bearish news, or even more bearish news than they were looking for, and the market didn't go down on it. And why is that? Well, it's because everybody's already short, which is how the whole idea started to begin with, right? But now the market action and the market tone is confirming that thought process. So that's how I enter a trade.
Given how much news is flooding into the markets every week, how do you differentiate between low and high importance news releases? And does the relative importance change much over time?
It definitely changes over time. How do I gauge it? You know, it's kind of, again, listening to the commentators and what they're all focusing on and what they're all talking about, you know, and when they're all agreeing, like, you know, this whole inflation thing right now is an example, right? Is like the big thing, right? So let's say for whatever reason, which I'm not, but let's say I were looking to get long stocks here, right? My data is showing me everybody's too short. I'm looking to get long. The CPI data is going to come out next week. And if we had some kind of hugely strong CPI number that was much higher than expectations, therefore being very inflationary, and then the stock market didn't go down on that, that's when I would be looking to buy. So like, it's just a question of listening. And, you know, with commodities, it's usually pretty the same thing. It's all the supply and demand numbers that come out. You know what I mean? although not necessarily, because with the Ukraine war, all of a sudden that started to affect, you know, a lot of the grain markets, and obviously a lot of the energy markets are being affected by that. So it's just a question of paying attention to, you know, what's really theoretically moving these markets, and therefore how is it reacting to as these news events come out.
Mm-hmm. So what you consider to be very important news items, do they get released frequently, like every week, or are they once a quarter, once a month, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it depends on the market. I mean, it seems like in the financial markets, you know, there's stuff released obviously all day, right? So that all affects stocks, bonds, currencies, you know. For the commodities, it tends to be more sort of monthly. You know, I know for the grains, I like to watch the WASDE report very much, and that's a monthly report. You know, the energies have a weekly report, right? A weekly supply demand report. So that's more weekly. And for the soft commodities, the grains tend to be more like once a month type of things. Although, like I say, that changes over time too, because you start having things like, you know, wars and shipping lines, you know, being blocked and all that. So that can be obviously, to me, when I'm looking at these news things, it has to be super obvious, right? I don't want it to be my interpretation, because that leads you to make trades just because you want to make them, right? And that's what I'm trying to avoid, right? So I'm looking for the news event to be headline news, obvious, so that my interpretation really doesn't have to be very much.
I've heard you mentioned in other interviews of having the importance of having a uncorrelated plays. Can you give us an example of an uncorrelated play that you put on?
So for me, you know, my portfolio gets built as I get individual trades, right? Mm-hmm. So whatever, I got long stocks, I got short British pound, I got whatever. And each trade gets, this is all about, you know, risk control, you know, risk and risk management. So each individual trade has its own risk management, right? Mm-hmm. But then as I have a portfolio of trades on, if the trades are highly correlated, then it's really not one trade, right? So you have to watch your risk management on that. So I'm measuring the correlation between my trades. And if these two trades have a correlation of one, well, then to me, it's the same trade. So I'm going to cut the risk on each one of them, because what's the point of having the same trade on twice if you're measuring your risk, right? So that's really the importance of correlation to me.
So when you put on a trade, typically how often do you find, or how many times do you typically get stopped out before catching a significant move in your favor?
It varies. Sometimes I get it right on the spot first time. And sometimes, sometimes I never get it. But the good thing about waiting for the news failure thing and the confirmation is that, like, it's not like I'm going to be buying it today, I get stopped. Okay, the next day I'm going to be buying it again, I get stopped. And you know, for this news failure event to happen, you know, that's not going to happen every day, right? Mm-hmm. So, there's plenty of times where I'll trade the thing three times or four times, get stopped four times, and then either my data goes away and it's no longer crowded, or I'm not getting any more news failure or whatever, and therefore it's kind of gone. So I guess it varies, truthfully. Yeah.
So, for example, say if you are looking to get long the commodity, say oil, for example, do you ever take a look at the oil stocks as maybe another way, or oil indices to go long, say the oil sector when it's extremely undervalued relative to the commodity on a historical basis, or the flip side, if you're looking to go short oil and you notice that the oil companies are extremely out of whack historically compared to the underlying crude oil prices. Do you ever trade the stocks at all, or the ETFs?
But if I did, I would hate that particular idea.
Oh, okay. Tell us why.
It's so easily observable, right? Uh-huh. That how can there possibly be an edge in there? You know, I mean, who can't pull up the oil versus oil stock chart at any time, right? mm-hmm. and say, I mean, we've been hearing this forever. The OIX has underperformed oil, right? Well, it's been underperforming oil for, you know, 15 years or something. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. Making up a number, but I mean, that's never helped you, right? It's so obvious and it's so easily observable by everybody that to me, and it almost goes against all good sort of trading ideas, which is things are lagging, buy the laggards, sell the leaders. Really, you're supposed to be buying the leaders and selling the laggards. So if you're going to sit there and buy the OIX or whatever it is because it's lagging oil, I don't think that's a very good idea at all, personally. It goes against every trading rule that I know. It mm-hmm. doesn't say it can't work sometimes. Everything can work sometimes, right? Mm-hmm. But it goes against every trading rule that I know.
Excuse the last interruption here. This is Tessa. We hope you're enjoying this episode so far. If you love the podcast, please give Chat with Traders the best review you can on whatever platform you're listening from. This will help us to keep the episodes coming. Also, if you haven't subscribed to our email list, please hop on to chatwithtraders.com and click on subscribe so we can keep you posted of information that may be of importance. Thank you. Now back to the chat with our guest.
Mm-hmm. So what indicators do you use to exit your positions?
So because I'm entering when things are showing speculators super crowded, mm-hmm. I am therefore exiting when speculators are no longer crowded. You know, my whole process, and this is what developing a process is, right? And developing an edge is, okay, once you have that process or that edge, it all has to align and make sense with each other. So I'm getting in because everyone's short. I'm getting out because everyone is no longer short.
I see. So are you looking for a more mean reversion to a typical average? Or do you ever hold on to your positions for the long term where the exact opposite would occur, where they go from excessively bullish to excessively bearish, for example?
Yeah, that's a good question. No, it's mean reversion. It's not mean reversion of price. It's mean reversion of participation, right? Mm-hmm. But what I have found is I would probably make more money over time if I buy it, let's say, when they're excessively short, and I hold it all the way until they're excessively long, right? Mm-hmm. But once it kind of gets past the midpoint there, where they're neutral now, the volatility of the portfolio goes up a lot more than the excess return. So I get out at the neutral point. It's also a question of I have a business and I have a job, and that business and job, I offer a product to my investors, which is to catch those market turns and therefore have this negative correlation to other people, right? Mm-hmm. Once the thing gets past the neutral point, that's the trend followers getting on board the trade, essentially, right? And that's their job. My job was to catch that turn, right? The first X percent move of that turn, right? Once they're getting on board, that's their job and I'm out, right? So mm-hmm. I've kind of done my job as far as my product goes. And plus the fact that the volatility ends up going up a lot more from that point, I also don't like personally. So
I see. Is there what typical time frame do you typically see from a reversion back to the mean in sentiment and participation?
You know, it's typically 2 to 4 months. Mm-hmm. I'm just trying to look, but yeah, like we were getting along the S&Ps back in June and we were getting out, you know, in August. So June, that was a 2 month one. So it's typically 2 to 4 months. Mm-hmm. Although I have had trades last 3 weeks. And I've had trades, you know, this is winning trades. Losing trades happen very quickly. I get stopped out. But and I actually had a winning trade last almost 2 years, a few years back. So, but typically 2 to 4 months.
Okay. In the book, Unknown Market Wizards, you shared that you managed a fund in New York and that you did really well making money every year where you used a counter trend approach. Can you describe what a counter trend approach is?
Well, this is exactly what we've been talking about. You know, right. I don't really think that it's counter trend, although mm-hmm. it can sometimes be that, because trend is more of a price thing by uh-huh. definition. A trend is price, right? Mm-hmm. I'm counter participation, right? So I'm counter when they're all short. I'm long when they're all long. I'm short. Now, it's no coincidence that a lot of times when everybody's short is when it's trending down, and when everybody's long is when it's trending up, right? That's not always the case, but it very often is. So you can call that counter trend. But yeah, that's what I do. That's what I still do. And that's what I've been doing for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Also, you mentioned in the in that interview with Jack Schwager that you were running a CTA fund and that you weren't particularly enjoying what you were doing and that you were 100% systematized. And you mentioned that you were bothered by return degradation. Can you describe what return degradation is and the reasons for it? Is this common when using program trading?
So, yeah, I mean, it was just that I left the hedge fund. I started my own CTA. And I had, you know, big dreams and big stars in my eyes. And, you know, I had a lot of employees and a lot of costs and therefore had to raise a lot of money. And part of the marketing game was, you know, a large portion of the allocators were allocating to systematic strategies. So we ran our strategy as a systematic strategy using all these ideas that I use, using the data that I already use, using all these things, right? Mm-hmm. So therefore we could raise more money and create, you know, more revenue to cover what I had as big costs. And what it turned out to do was our returns were worse than the returns that I had produced before and since, you know. So that's what return degradation is, you know. I use the same system that I used for that. I still use, but I use discretion on top of it, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes my system will say buy something and I won't buy it. Or same thing on the sell, you know. I won't make any trades now that my system doesn't say make, but there are trades that I will make that I won't make that my system does say make. And that's because I have learned, partially through that process of when we were fully systemized, I've learned where the weaknesses are in the system, right, over time. And I can recognize them, that this is the weakness in the system. So therefore, I can sort of ignore those trades.
Mm-hmm. And what percentage of the time do you override the recommendation of your system and not take the trade?
It varies across time, but I would say 20 to 25%.
Mm-hmm. I see. So are you currently managing other people's money or just your own?
No, I currently manage a CTA. I have five institutional accounts. Mm-hmm. I work as a one-man operation. And, you know, I offer this non-correlated return stream to my clients, and that's really it. I'm not raising any money. I'm not accepting new clients or anything like that. I'm at a place where I'm happy to do what I'm doing now, and we're doing it. I did start after Market Wizards came out. I was getting a lot of requests from people on LinkedIn and on Facebook if I could help them learn how to trade and all that. They somehow, some people liked the contrarian approach, liked some of the things I was saying, were asking me if I could help them learn. And I think that that's an important thing to do, especially when you reach, you know, my age. You kind of want to help people, but I was getting so many of these requests that I can't sit here and, you know, teach 250 people at the same time, because I have a job and I have a business and I have a family and I have a lot of things that I'm doing. So we did start this web page. It was one of the people who came to me, and I said to him, I don't really have the time. And he started the web page where we then go and I distribute this newsletter that I write. And we have a Discord chat where everybody kind of gets on there and talks about markets all day and talks about, you know, it turned into something I didn't know it was going to turn into. Originally, I just thought it was going to be a way to distribute this newsletter and maybe answer some questions for people. But it's turned into this whole community of people. And it's interesting. I've learned just as much from them as I think that they've learned from me. There's a whole bunch of different traders from all over the world talking on there about their ideas. I focus on what I do. they focus on what they do, and they all kind of talk and learn from each other. And it's become an interesting thing.
So in closing, is there any like one or two pieces of advice you could give to traders when they're experiencing losses? You know, kind of what would you say to them?
Be honest about it, right? Realize and try and realize why they're happening so that you can learn from them. I think that when you're losing money, is the greatest time to educate yourself and the greatest time to get better. Because when you're making money, you're not going to try to get better because you figure you're already a genius, right? And losing money is the wake-up call that can help you to really get to work and get better. And I think if you're losing money, and I lose money all the time, unfortunately, but you know, if you're losing money in a process that works over time, then the thing to do is just accept that as part of a, you know, as part of the process, you know,
right.
If your account, I mean, I've been trading pretty much the same process for 20 years and my account was on new all-time highs very recently. So if I have a 2-week period where I'm losing money, it's like, well, I don't think that that was the end of what I've been doing for 20 years. I think it's still valid. And this is just part of what goes on. You're not going to make money every day, every week, every month, every quarter, you know, it's just not realistic. So I would say those are the two things.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like having a process can help protect us from our own psychological demons.
I think that is 100% the entire thing. Yes, of what this is all about. You have to have a process to protect you from your own psychological demons.
All right. Well, Jason, it's great having you on the show. Thank you very much for sharing about your history and your viewpoints and strategies. How can our listeners get in contact with you?
So yeah, we've got this crowdedmarketreport.com,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, like I was talking about this newsletter and Discord chat service that we do. There's also, I do some videos on YouTube, which mm-hmm. I think it's also under Crowded Market Report on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to some people there as well. So those are the two places where people can get in touch with me.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, Jason.
All right. I appreciate your time.
Yeah.
Or I appreciate you having me.
Great. Great having you.
Thanks.
You've reached the end of this episode of Chat with Traders. But rest assured, there are more episodes loaded with real market insight and zero hype on the way soon. So to stay updated with each great new release, subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, and we'd love it if you'd leave a rating and review. We'll catch you next time on Chat with Traders.